This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is time to ask the doctors. Wastewater data in Massachusetts continues to rise. Our case numbers higher, actually, than they were this time last year. Kids ages 5 to 11, they can now get a booster, but kids under 5 still can't get a first shot. Public health officials say the goal no longer to avoid infections, but severe illness and death, as some raise the specter of a person potentially having multiple COVID cases each year. There is a lot to talk about. And you texted us a lot of questions for today. So we're going to jump right in. With us, two infectious disease specialists from Tufts Medical Center. Welcoming back Dr. Helen Boucher. Welcome back, Dr. Boucher.
Thanks so much, Tiziana. Nice to be with you.
And welcoming back Dr. Gabriela Andujar-Vazquez. Welcome back to you as well.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Dr. Andujar-Vazquez, I'll start with you and the state of COVID here. So spring was kind of supposed to be the time. It got warmer and it was going to get a little better. We thought maybe this year we move into the endemic phase of this virus. But now almost all Massachusetts counties are high risk for COVID. The wastewater looks like it did in January, nationally sicker than we were last year. And last year we were just beginning to roll out vaccines. So put it in context. What's going on?
Yeah, I know that this is the fact that the cases are going up and currently and you know, when you compare with other surges that we've had, we were hopeful that this wouldn't happen as precipitously as we're seeing right now. But I think that there's a couple of things that are different and in a good way in this time during this time. You mentioned vaccines, you know, they still are effective and they still are avoiding hospitalizations. And then the other key part is therapeutics. We have now pills that you can take at home if you get COVID. We have other medications that we can give through intravenously. And I think that that has actually changed our hospitalizations. And even with that, also the deaths that we are still not seeing increasing, which is good. So even though we're living through another surge with all the barriers and discouragement that could sound, and I think that we are in a better position today than we were in previous surges.
So Dr. Boucher, I'm actually going to pick up on the reference that Dr. Andujar-Vazquez just made to pills for treatment now, and I'm going to go to one of the questions we got in our texting group. This is from Liz from Stoneham. She had several questions, but I'm going to give you this piece. Can you explain what the antivirals are supposed to do if someone who tests positive and is prescribed them, you know, i.e. Paxlovid? I keep reading the patients have quote-unquote COVID rebound. So who is supposed to get this medication and what are the pros and cons? So confusing. Dr. Boucher.
Yeah, no, great question. So the oral antivirals that Dr. Andujar mentioned include the drug Paxlovid, which is the most effective of the options that we have available. And these medicines are now widely available in our state with multiple ways to get them via telemedicine or in person. So I definitely recommend you call your doctor if you're diagnosed with COVID. Most of the population actually is recommended for medication. There are some contraindications, and that's why it's important to talk to your doctor. But if you get the medicine, it is designed to directly attack the virus and knock down the virus and shorten the duration of your symptoms and the severity of your symptoms. And it's been proven to be 90% effective at keeping people out of the hospital. So that's really good news. It can have some funny taste and maybe some other milder side effects, but it's quite well tolerated. So the second thing you mentioned is this observation of rebound. And there have been some patients who have been treated with Paxlovid who have an initial response. They feel better. They are better. And then maybe a week later, you know, after the symptoms started, they start to have symptoms again. And this has been reported, and nothing, I would say, to be overly concerned about. In fact, viruses do this as well. So we're still teasing out how much of this is related to the medicine versus the virus itself. But all in all, I think it's important to remember that these medicines are 90% effective at keeping you from getting sick enough to go to the hospital with COVID.
All right. Thank you for that, Dr. Boucher. I want to pick up now on a couple of things having to do with reinfection. So I'm going to put a question of mine and a question from a member of our texting group together for you, Dr. Andujar-Vazquez. So Sonia in Boston says, Are there still concerns over long-term effects of COVID? And what happens if you get COVID twice? Is that dangerous? And I'll pair that with what is the level of threat of reinfection at this point for people who have had COVID already?
Right. A very interesting question. You know, there's a proportion of the population that seems to be, I would say, quote unquote, more susceptible to reinfection than others. You know, we have here about one third of the U.S. population that has never had COVID, or at least they know of. And then we have a big proportion of the population that has had it, and not once, but twice, or sometimes even three times, just based on the surveillance data. And so we're still trying to understand what are the risk factors for individuals that get COVID to go into long COVID. There was actually a recent study published just this week about a big group of population. It was in a particular private insurer, so it's not representative of everyone in the U.S., right? But it was a big study where they were looking at trying to understand what risk factors the American citizens have to go into long COVID. It seems that it's more likely to happen in individuals that are middle-aged, and more likely to happen in when you have mild to moderate disease, as opposed to being hospitalized with it, which is very interesting. I think we have a lot to learn on how to, you know, a lot of studies are ongoing on how to address these issues. I don't think that the more you have COVID, like if you have it once, twice, or three times, we're not sure if that increases your chances of getting long COVID. I think that we do have an idea that being vaccinated might help avoiding that, particularly in younger individuals, which are the highest risk group for long COVID.
So just to summarize a couple of key things there, it sounds like there's a lot we still don't know about long COVID, and also that your risks of long COVID as well as reinfection really might be really based on the individual. We can't necessarily make blanket statements on those things yet.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's correct.
All right. So let me come back to you, Dr. Boucher. One of the other things that's come up a lot is this question about, do we know how many infections we really have? So let me put this in perspective. Last year, 7-day average test positivity rate was hovering about 1%. Now that number is over 9%. But also, we were testing fewer people last year, but when we did test people, it was pretty much getting reported all the time because it was PCR tests in a hospital or clinic kind of environment. And let me clarify, this time last year specifically. Now, there are reports, there was a report in the Boston Globe saying we may be underestimating positivity by as many as 3.5 times because people are home testing. So what do we and don't know about our positivity rates right now? And how concerning is it that they're so much higher than at this time last year?
Yeah, so this is another great question. And you hit on a couple of the key points, Tiziana, right? So a lot is different this year than last year. We have vaccinated people and we have people testing at home. So there are fewer people getting PCR tests, and we know that more of them are symptomatic. So the kind of rate of positivity reflects likely positivity among people who are symptomatic and more likely to have COVID. So certainly we've got more COVID. I think it's, you know, the modelers are doing the work to kind of estimate how much we may be under or over appreciating. The wastewater helps us, and the wastewater gives us a snapshot of what's going on, and that's not a great number, right? It's still not to the levels that we saw with the Omicron surge, but it's still trending in the wrong direction. So we are looking less at cases, and Dr. Andujar mentioned this sort of disconnect that is good, right, that we're seeing in a vaccinated state like Massachusetts, where we have highly vaccinated individuals and a lot of people who've had COVID. There's a disconnect between infections and either hospitalizations or death, which is really good. And that means that the COVID is not causing as much trouble as it has in the past. And that is very reassuring from a public health standpoint.
All right, thanks. I want to now pick up a voicemail question that we received from one of our listeners in our texting group. This is Sean in Brighton, who is a mental health clinician at a local school.
Hi, my name is Sean from Brighton. I work at a high school, and between January and now, a lot of the kids and staff have gotten COVID. I'm wondering what you can say about the mental health effects after an infection, as well as how long it might take for a fully vaccinated person to recover their stamina, and what supports they need, even if they don't have long COVID.
So I was particularly intrigued about the question about mental health effects, especially when it takes a long time to recover, Dr. Andujar Vasquez. I know when I had COVID at the end of December, beginning of January, the fatigue lasted so long, it wears on you. So what conversations are we having about the mental health effects of having had COVID?
Yeah, great question. And even though mental illness may be outside of my expertise, we do work closely with a lot of our mental health experts around the COVID and related issues like this. You know, at baseline, the pandemic has affected us in many ways that we are yet to even quantify or even describe in terms of mental health. And that on top of getting infected with the virus can also take a toll into individuals, families, loved ones, friends, right? We have learned to live with not only being sick with the COVID and what that may mean for our own health, but also worrying about people we maybe live with, making sure that we did the right thing about getting tested and not exposing individuals. And then it's like the uncertainty of having COVID and then, will I be fine? Will I have long COVID, like the caller mentioned, yeah. and what to do about that? You know, COVID behaves similarly to other viruses that we do see quite often in the infectious disease world, like, you know, infectious mononucleosis and other herpetic viruses, where people take some time to recover, which is interesting about viruses in general. And so trying to cope with all of that while, going back to some sort of normalcy after trying to, it's hard. And certainly I don't have any particular tips or tricks on how to navigate that. But I think that the one thing I would recommend on people that have had COVID and are struggling with recovery physically and mentally is to speak out, follow with their, physicians and talk about it, right? Be open about it. So we can together navigate those issues that maybe our patients are struggling with and try our best, right, to help make people feel better mentally and anemically.
Thank you for that. So I'm going to go back to our texting group, Dr. Boucher. This one's from Tammy in Rowley. I have a question regarding booster shots for those ages 5 to 11. My soon-to-be 12-year-old received Pfizer in December. Now he is eligible for the booster. Will it be okay for him to get the adult dose of the booster once he turns 12 in June, or should he receive the kid's dose of booster since his original vaccine was the kid's dose? And again, just acknowledging that Pfizer's vaccine was just authorized for boosters for kids ages 5 to 11.
Yeah, so, you know, certainly I'm not a pediatrician, so I would recommend asking the pediatrician. And I think the most important thing is that he gets the booster. If he turns 12, he's eligible for that age 12 dose. And so that's what the package would suggest. But again, I think it's important to ask your child's pediatrician for the right advice for him or her.
And Dr. Boucher, I'll stay with you for a second longer because I can just feel the collective frustration of our listeners whose kids are under five, right? Saying, so wait, kids 5 to 11 now can get boosted. My kids still can't get vaccinated. So this is my weekly check-in. When do we think that's coming, Dr. Boucher? Any idea?
Yeah, I certainly don't have a crystal ball. And, I know everybody's working hard to make sure that the data are reviewed and of the quality that we need to know that vaccines are safe and effective for small children. The thing I do want to just emphasize is that the data continue to show us, thankfully, that the risk to those small kids is proportionately low, right? The smaller kids don't overall get as sick with COVID. So obviously we want the vaccine to come, but parents should be reassured by those data as well. And kids are back in daycare and school and preschool and all those activities.
Thanks for that, Dr. Andujar Vasquez. Pat and Wayland is going to give us a good chance to review a couple of basics. And we're on a little bit of a tight time frame here, but Pat and Wayland asks, how long is a person supposed to quarantine if they have tested positive? And if you've been exposed but haven't tested positive, is there a quarantine protocol? This is a great time to remind people of what those basics are.
Yes, absolutely. Great time. So in the community, we are expected, if we have COVID infection, to be in isolation for a total of 5 days. And as long as we're fever-free and improving, we're allowed to get out of isolation day 6, but with the assurance that we are gonna wear a mask around others for the remaining 5 other days, right? For a total of 10 days. So that what that means is like you're in strict isolation for 5 days, and then day 6 to 10, I'm wearing a mask around others, even at home, to decrease that chance of transmission. Because we know that by day average 6 to 8, we are less infectious to others at that point, which is why we are able to get out of isolation by day 6. And in terms of quarantine, if you're exposed, you know you're exposed when we're in close contact with an individual, the recommendation is to wear a mask around others during the between day 1 to 10 days total, and monitor for symptoms, right? Making sure that if you have fever, cough, any of those respiratory symptoms, that you go ahead and get tested right away and isolate until you get your test results.
And to clarify, the day you find out you've been exposed, or the day you were exposed, or the day you test positive, that's day 0, right?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely right. That can be a little confusing when we count. But basically, day 0 is the day that you find out the test is positive, or the day that you started having symptoms. And then we start counting day 1 the next day.
All right. Doctors Gabriela Andujar Vasquez and Helen Boucher are both infectious disease physicians at Tufts Medical Center. They're both also on the faculty of the Tufts University School of Medicine. Want to thank you both for helping us with Ask the Doctors today. Hope to have you back again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you heard a lot of great questions and a voicemail from listeners who have joined our texting club. We'd like you to join, too, so you can engage with us about the stories and segments on the show. To do that, text the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. It's the word Boston. Thanks so much, and we'll be back with more Radio Boston after a break.